let's maximize our time and let's just jump right in. You'll notice there on your handout, everybody get a handout? If you notice on your handout, we're going to talk about the three big rocks. The lesson is big rocks first, little rocks not at all. And I can teach this anywhere in the world but Little Rock, Arkansas. And so, all right. That's my mad attempt at a joke. The three big rocks we're going to look at, as you see, is leadership, vision, and execution. And so it asks you there, which of these big rocks do you think is most important? Now, I want to say they're all important, and I think each enhances the other. But let's dissect the frog here a minute. If you have to say which one of those were the most important there, just put a check mark next to leadership, vision, or execution as the one that you think is most important. You got it? Now, do you know what Baptists do best? We've already done it tonight. Eat. That's exactly right. That's what we do best. You know what Baptists do second best? No. Well, that's pretty good. Vote. We love to go to business meetings and vote. So I'm going to give you a chance to vote. How many of you checked leadership? All right. Who checked vision? All right. Execution? Okay. Well, we got a split vote here, don't we? Well, they're all important now. And if we had time, I would let you share why you checked it, because you will come up and with a very good reason why that one is very important, and they all are important. But let me vote. You don't have to agree with my vote, but if I was voting on the three, I would vote leadership as the number one. And let me just tell you why I would. Where does vision come from? A leader. Where does execution come from? A leader. And that's the reason I would personally choose that one. But nonetheless, they're all important. Now, let's dive into them then. And let's start off looking at the big rock number one, leadership. And you know, when you throw a big rock in the pond, it creates a big splash, doesn't it? So what's the big splash from big rock number one? And here it is. It's in your notes. Our leadership is perfectly designed to produce the results we're getting. Now, I want that to settle in. Now, I'm telling you, that statement has eaten my lunch now for a year or two. My leadership at my church is perfectly designed to produce the results I'm getting. Now, can I just be honest with y'all? I don't like all the results I'm getting. Now, we need to understand something about leadership. You see, often if there's a problem, what the leader does, he walks over to the window and he looks out at everybody in his organization to say, oh, there's the problem. Or no, he's the problem or she's the problem. But remember now, your leadership is perfectly designed to produce the results that you're getting. So here it is, leaders. Before you ever look out the window, you first look in the mirror. The bottom line, at my church, the problem with our Sunday school, at my church, I see that problem every morning when I shave. It's the reason I'm thinking about growing a beard. I won't have to look at him. But my leadership is perfectly designed to produce the results I'm getting. I want you to think about your leadership right now. What kind of results are you getting? Now, you may say, well, Alan, I just started. Okay, if that's the case, then those results aren't yours yet. But you see, after you've been there a while, it's the seeds that you sow and you reap from that. So after you've been in that position, whatever length of time would be the appropriate time, then the results you get are on you, not on your predecessor. So, again, amen or oh me? Yeah, a little of both maybe. Okay. Now, these next two bullet points are statements that probably John Maxwell's made more popular than anyone, but the first one is everything rises and falls with leadership. Now, I don't know how you feel about that, but I agree with that. Because, again, if my leadership is perfectly designed to produce the results I'm getting, then it's my leadership that is causing things to rise or to fall. Okay? And the second bullet point there is the principle of the leadership lid, and that is the leader is the lid of his organization or her organization. And wherever that lid is, nothing gets above it because you're the top. And everything else is hitting up against it potentially. And so the best way to lift your organization is to lift you if you're the lid. All right. Now, I want us to look at three things that the leader sets. He sets it in place by his or her leadership. First of all is direction. Direction. Again, another word for that's vision, and we'll talk about that when we get into the big rock of vision, so we won't spend a whole lot of time here, but I did want to mention it. Look at point A, if you would. Leadership should direct the organization more than circumstances. Now, the reason I say that is because In a lot of Bible study classes across America, it's not the direction and the vision that's leading that. It's the circumstances. Now, I want to say something to be fair and balanced, as Fox News has taught us. And that is, there are times and there are certain circumstances that will drive things. But I'm afraid too often in our Bible study groups, it's petty things and petty circumstances that drive. Now, you probably got your war stories like I do, but, I mean, over the years, I've dealt with things about a class that, for instance, I had a class that they called it the couch class. Now, it was at a former church, and the room was just full of old couches. Well, at some point, you couldn't put people in the room. It was being taken up with furniture. And Jesus never died for furniture. He died for people. But the circumstances of this, it was a men's class. They did not want to move those couches out of there. And there's more to it than that. But the circumstance of a couch was driving that class, not the vision or the mission of the class. Now, I could give you a few more war stories, but you got your own. You don't need mine. But too often, circumstances is driving things instead of vision. The second thing there is, if you're the leader, if you don't direct the personnel and the finances, you're not the leader. What is personnel and what is finances? It's the two most valuable resources you throw at the vision. If you, whatever the vision, the direction is, and of course, Ben's laid it out in this book. I've read it. He sent it to me a couple of weeks ago so I could be prepared when I came, and I read through it, and it's in there. But you see, if you're going to fulfill that mission statement for your life Bible study groups, you got to have people to do it, and at some point you got to have some kind of money. And so that's what leaders do. They direct that. They oversee that, and they use those valuable resources to get them there. Again, we'll talk more about direction because it really fits under vision, but I wanted to set it here because I want us to look at these three main things that leaders do or set in place. Secondly, let's look at standards. Leaders set standards. Notice point A. The second job of leadership is to set standards. The first job of leadership is to meet standards. Now, let me just give you a standard at our church as an example. But at our church, if you're going to be a Bible study teacher, you must be a tither. I set that standard. Guess what? Before I set it, I had to make sure I was meeting it. Which I did. I've been a tither all my life. But I can't ask them to meet a standard of that if I'm not meeting it myself. So the second job of leadership is to set the standard, but the first job of leadership is to meet the standard. And then look at the first bullet point there. In every organization on earth, the leader has a higher standard. Now, we know that's true in business. Let's just take the local bank here. Who has the higher standard on them at the bank, the bank president or the bank teller? Bank president. Why? He's the leader. Let's look in the realm of sports. Who has the higher standard on them, the head coach or the assistant coach? Well, the head coach, he's the leader. Let's look in the home. Who has a higher standard on them, the parent or the child? Well, the parent. They're the leader. The leader always has a higher standard in any organization on God's green earth but the church. And often in the church, the leader has the lower standard. And then we want to know why our organizations are not working effectively, why our classes are not working effectively. It's because the leader don't have the standard on him that he ought to have. Y'all right? So, dear friend, if you're the leader, you've got to meet a higher standard. And if not, then you're the lid that's lowered it way down. And then you want to know why whatever it is you're leading is not going anywhere. And your leadership is perfectly designed to produce the results you're getting. How y'all doing? All right. The leader has a higher standard. But look at the next bullet point. In every organization, the leader sets the standards. Now, let's go right back to business world. Let's go back down to the bank. Who tells that teller you will clock in at 9 and you will clock out at 5? Well, the bank president. Why? He's the leader, and the leader sets standards. Who is it that tells the players, we are going to have two-a-day practices in August. You will be in the weight room at such and such time. Well, the coach. Why? He's the leader. In the home, who is it that tells that teenager your curfew's at 11 o'clock? Or who tells that child, no, you're not going out to play till your homework's done? Well, the parent does what? They're the leader. Leaders have a higher standard on them, but leaders also set standards for everybody else in their organization. Well, they're supposed to. And in fact, that's true in every organization on God's green earth, but the church. And in the church, it's the book of Judges. Every man just does what's right in his own eyes. And then we want to know why we're not moving and growing and doing the things that we say is our mission. Look at point B. Commitment is premium. Commitment is premium. It trumps everything else. The last session that we did, a couple of these guys were in there, but I talked about this. Let's look at this. The bullet point is, failure we can accept, apathy we cannot. At my church, I say this all the time to our Sunday school leaders. I do not mind if they fail, but I do mind if they're not trying to succeed. I do mind if they're not trying to accomplish the mission. I mean, of course, living there in the Atlanta area, I'm a Braves fan. I really don't mind it if a player strikes out, but I do mind it if he sits there and watches three pitches go right down the pike and never swings. Failure, we can handle. Apathy, we cannot. And so, and one of the reasons I say that to our Sunday school leaders at our church is because I want them to accept my failure too, don't you see? Because we're all going to. There's a great statement in here by Coach Pat Riley, coached the Lakers and the Knicks and the Miami Heat. And he said, there are only two options regarding commitment. You're either in or you're out. There's no such thing as life in between. Now, I don't know if he's a believer or not, but that almost sounds like what a Christian ought to be saying. In fact, stop and think about something a minute. It reminds me of what Jesus said. He said, I would rather you be hot or cold, but not lukewarm. Why? There's no life in between. You're either committed or you're not. There's no life in between. And so, again, commitment. And then this next bullet point is, you can't be anything until you're first committed. You just can't be anything until you're first committed. I believe our cemeteries are full of good Christian people. But people who came to church, warmed a pew, maybe threw a little money in the offering plate some, lived a, you know, moral life, and died and never really accomplished much for God. Why? Was it because they weren't competent? No, they were competent. When they got saved, God gave them a spiritual gift. You see, it's not, folks, it's not competency that's hurting our churches. It's commitment. And so what happens, and I think about this often when I go to a funeral or do a funeral. I think about so often when we lower that body, that corpse into the ground, we've also not only buried a dead corpse, but we've also buried all of their God-given potential that never got used. They took the potential that God put in them and they took it to the grave with them. Not because they weren't competent, because they never were committed with the competency they had. And that's the reason I'd rather have commitment over competency. When we are enlisting a worker, we'll give them what we call a ministry description. It's a job description, but we're in the ministry. I like the word ministry description better. And so we're going to have, here's, we want you to do this, 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 whatever. But at the top of the page, it'll give whatever the position is. And then underneath it, it's going to have this statement in your notes. Competency we want, commitment we need. Because I want them to understand up front, I'd rather have your commitment as anything else. Folks, you can't build a great life Bible study with uncommitted people. Let me rephrase that. You cannot build a great life Bible study with uncommitted leaders. It cannot be done. Leaders set direction, leaders set standards, and thirdly, leaders set atmosphere. Now, what do I mean by atmosphere? I mean that feeling, that ambiance, the environment that's in the room, the aura, the energy, the synergy, all those kind of words I'm trying to wrap up in this word atmosphere. Now, point A, let's state the obvious. We are in the people business. That's the reason we're there. You know, I hear every now and then a teacher, they'll say something like, well, now, Brother Allen, I just teach the Bible. To which I respond and say, no, you don't. What do you mean? You never taught the Bible anything. You teach people. Now, I know what they mean by that statement. It's a good statement. I've used it myself, so I'm just playing on words there. But the truth is, you know, if I talk to an English teacher and she said, I teach English, I'd say, no, you don't. You teach people. We're in the people business. We've got to understand that. And because of that, it's important that there is this certain atmosphere that we create. Now look at point B. Leaders need to create an atmosphere of love, acceptance, and friendliness. We've got to create that. And let me say, there is a way to do that. And let me make another statement. Leaders don't get what they want. They get what they create. So, how are you going to develop this atmosphere of love, acceptance, and friendliness? Well, look at point C. There's three key practices for, I believe, Christian leaders. Now, the world has its four-letter words, but for the Christian leader, here's our five-letter words. Very simple. Speak, smile, and touch. Now, here's what I want to say to you. Sunday morning, you need to get there early. I tell our leaders, you ought to be there about 15 minutes early. No later than 10 minutes early. And it depends on what you have to do, but if you have to set up the room or whatever else, you may have to get there a little bit earlier. But here's the bottom line. You ought to have everything ready to go so that when the first person walks through the door on Sunday morning, you're ready to speak and or smile and or touch. It ought to be your goal every Sunday morning as a life Bible group leader. It ought to be your goal every week to speak and or smile and or touch everybody in your class. Now, there'll be some Sundays, they're rare, but occasionally somebody's going to come in and they've had a terrific issue over the weekend or whatever, and they just need to get you over in a corner of the room and they need to talk to you a little bit, and you just need to maybe love on them, pray with them, and maybe God has it that day that your ministry is really to that one person. That happens some. But on the regular Sunday, you ought to do your best to go speak, smile, and touch everybody in your group. Now, it's real simple. When you do those three things, you give a person attention. And when you give a person attention, that communicates to them that, hey, I like you. I value you. You are significant to me. Now, and how long does it take to do that? It don't take long. Hey, good morning. How you doing today? Had a good week? Great. Oh, good to see you. It don't take long to do this. But you see, when you don't do those things, you don't give them attention. And when you don't give them attention, you communicate to them. Their perception is, he don't like me. He don't care about me. He don't think I'm significant. Now you say, Alan, how do you know that? Because that's how I feel when people snub me and walk on down the hallway. I got to tell you this story because it really marked me. I've got a Sunday morning routine. Maybe y'all do, but every Sunday morning, I'm going to do the same thing. It's very unusual that I don't. I get up the same time. I go through the same routine to get dressed. Saturday night's the only night I lay out my clothes for the next day because I want Sundays to go smooth. On my way to church, I'll stop by Starbucks down there and get me a cup of coffee, and I know the ladies down there real good, and I walk in, they know what I want, they just go get it, and then I get it, and I drive on to church, and when I get to church, I get in there long enough to have my quiet time and my prayer time, and then our first Sunday school hour starts at 8 o'clock, and I hit the hallways a little bit before 8 for one reason: speak, smile, and touch, because I'm the leader. I'm trying to set an atmosphere for all of it. Well, one Sunday, I don't know if it was a special Sunday or what, but for some reason, I parked on the other side of the campus. I never park over there. And I came in a different building, in a different door. I don't know why, but when I walked in the door, there was a senior adult lady there, and her name's Betty. And so I said, well, hello, Miss Betty. And she was handing out the bulletins for the morning and greeting people when they came in. And so I took the bulletin, and I gave her a little hug, and I said, good morning. And when I did, I saw a tear go down her cheek. And so I said, Miss Betty, is everything all right? And she said, oh yeah, everything's okay. And I said, well, I thought I saw a tear. And she said, well, you did. And I said, well, is there a story behind that tear? She said, well, yeah, actually there is. She said, Alan, if you'll remember, my husband passed away 2 years ago. And I said, yes, ma'am, I remember that. And then she said, all of my children and all of my grandchildren live out of state. And I talked to them, at least one of them, every day. I got a wonderful children and grandchildren, and they love me and all that. But she said, Alan, I literally go all week long with no physical means of affirmation. And her kids will call up and tell her, Mom, I love you. Her grandkids will call up, hey, Grandma, I love you. But she never gets a touch physically. And that morning when I walked in and hugged her, it was the first time somebody had touched her since the previous Sunday. And then she said this, Alan, that's the only reason I work here as a greeter. And so I will get some kind of means of physical affirmation. I'm going to tell you, that marked me. I hadn't forgot it. And that's a reason, especially if you're teaching widows or widowers or singles, I touch them. Now, I know we're all hung up on sex and all this kind of stuff, and I know there's a right and wrong way to touch people. I get that. But people need to be touched. I want you to stop thinking about some. Almost every time, there are a couple of exceptions, but almost every time Jesus healed somebody, how did he do it? He touched them. Listen, all Jesus had to do was speak the word, and they were healed. He told the winds to stop. He told the seas to be smooth, and bam, they were. And all he had to do with Lazarus is say, come forth. He never touched, and he comes out. Jesus didn't have to touch nobody. Why did Jesus elect to touch people? Now, the Bible don't say, but I have an opinion. How about you? I believe Jesus wanted them to receive the healing power of God, but I also think he wanted them to feel the compassionate touch of God. I'm telling you, well, speak. And by the way, if you smile a lot, people actually think you're a nice person. You ever notice that? They do. Oh, he's a nice guy. Well, anyway, he always smiles at me. Well, he just robbed somebody. I don't know, he's a nice guy. He smiles. Okay. But you see, folks, here's what I'm telling you. In March, I do a four-week potential teacher training. And in March, I've got four straight Sundays I will do potential teacher training. And we got about 51 people lined up. And I want to tell you what I'm going to tell them in there, because one of the lessons, I deal with this kind of stuff. And here's what I tell those teachers. After you've been in your class a while, now different classes and different people, the time frame would be different. But at some point, your class will take on your personality. Because you see, your leadership's perfectly designed to produce the results you're getting. And so you just need to know that some point out there in the future, when I come to your class, if nobody in your class speaks to me, it's going to tell me you're a snob. Now, I didn't say you weren't a good Bible teacher. You may be the greatest Bible teacher in America. But the truth is, your class will take on this personality. You create your own atmosphere. That's the reason you get there early, and that's the reason you speak, smile, and touch. Folks, we're in the people business. Now, you got to understand something about me. I'm not a huggy, huggy, kissy, kissy person. I grew up in a home with four boys. My dad checked out when I was five. My mama had to go to work. And so mama never had a chance much to huggy, huggy, kissy, kissy on us because she went to work, come home, cook supper, and then wash blue jeans. And then started the next day and did it all over again. I didn't grow up that way. But I've learned that people are emotional. And God's made us that way. And we need to create the right atmosphere. I'm going to tell you, when they do, or when we do, they'll listen to our lessons better. They'll buy into our vision better. They'll be more forgiving of us when maybe our lesson wasn't quite as good as what we thought it was. I'm telling you, this thing of atmosphere is critical. All right. The bullet point there is these three key practices position your people and your organization in an environment conducive for peak performance. Let's go to big rock number two. That's vision. It's big rock. And look at the big splash from big rock number two, and that is simply this. In the absence of a clearly defined vision, people perform daily acts of trivia. I'm telling you, it's facts. That's the reason circumstances drive too many Sunday school classes, because there's no vision. And when there's no vision, people just perform daily acts, or in our case, maybe weekly acts of trivia. And that is the fault of leadership. That is not the fault of followership. It's a leader's job to clearly communicate the vision. And so we don't want our people performing daily acts of trivia. So look here. The vision of the Sunday school is set forth from the life and teaching of Jesus Christ. And the bullet point is Jesus is the leader, so he sets the vision. Now, our problem is this. We're more committed to our fellowship than our mission. Now, I want that to really penetrate. I hear people in churches sometimes, they talk about the good old days. Oh, I wish we could go back to the good old days. Can I translate that for you? That means I love the fellowship and all that we had back then. But you see, maybe God used all that to get you where you are now along the journey for the mission so you can do more mission. But the bottom line is we love our fellowship more than we do our mission. We ought to love our fellowship. I just talked about atmosphere, so that's fellowship. We ought to love it. But folks, we got to love our mission. And the mission is set forth by Jesus. If you've got your Bibles, look in Matthew, if you would, chapter 4 and verse 23. And I want us to see something about the life of Christ. In Matthew chapter 4 and verse 23, the scripture says this, and Jesus went about all Galilee. Any of y'all been to Galilee before? I've had a couple of opportunities to be in the Holy Land, and I'll tell you what I was doing in Galilee. I was just meandering around as a tourist, taking it all in. And then eventually we got on that boat, so we'd go across the Sea of Galilee and eat lunch over at St. Peter's Fish House. That's what I was doing in Galilee. But you see, Jesus wasn't there as a tourist. Jesus lived a specific, on-purpose life. Very intentional about that. And the scripture says he was in Galilee, so we got asked the question, Jesus, what are you doing in Galilee? And that verse goes on to tell us in Matthew 4:23, it says he was teaching in their synagogues. It says he was preaching the gospel of the kingdom. That word preaching there in the Greek is the word we get our word evangelism from. He was out evangelizing by preaching the gospel. And then thirdly, it says he was healing all manner of sickness and all manner of disease among the people. And so the three tasks of Sunday school is derived from that, and it is to, there number two, reach people, teach people, and minister to people, because that's what Jesus did. He was reaching people, preaching the gospel. He was teaching people in their synagogues, and he was ministering to people by healing them of their sicknesses and their diseases. That was Matthew 4:23. Now turn over to Matthew 9:35. In Matthew chapter 9, in verse 35, the scripture says this, and Jesus went about all the cities and villages, Now, obviously, he's spreading out from Galilee. That was his hometown region. And so he's spreading out. And so we asked a question. Jesus, when you go in these cities and villages, what are you doing? Did you know that from that point on, after giving the location change, it's an exact quote of Matthew 4:23. Matthew 9:35 says he went throughout all the cities and villages, teaching in the synagogues, preaching, evangelizing, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every sickness and every disease among the people. Many, many, many years ago, my wife and I was taking some vacation, went to Florida and got us a little condo there on the beach. Before I left, I just printed out just off 8.5, 11 sheets of paper off my computer. I printed off Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John because I knew what I was going to do while we were at the beach. And every morning when I got up to do my quiet time, I read through that stack of papers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And I took some highlighters with me, and every time I saw Jesus reaching people, I would take out my orange highlighter, and I would highlight that verse in orange. And every time I saw Jesus teaching people, I would take out my green highlighter, and I would highlight that verse in green. And every time I saw Jesus ministering to people, I'd take out my blue highlighter, and I would highlight that verse in blue. At the end of our time down there at the beach, I got finished and had that little old stack of papers there on the little old coffee table in that condo, and I thought, man, I have wore these highlighters out. And so I picked up the ream of papers and just thumbed through it to see the colors, and they were all over those pages. And I hadn't planned on doing this, but it roused my curiosity, so I thought, I wonder how many of those verses I've highlighted. And then I thought, well, before I count them, how many total verses are in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? So I went back and counted. There's 3,776 verses in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And out of those 3,776 verses, I had highlighted 2,014 verses. And some of those, I mean, you read Matthew chapter 1, this one fellow that you can't pronounce his name, he begat that other fellow that you can't pronounce his name. Well, you can't highlight that verse. Huh? Verses about John the Baptist, you can't highlight those verses. But I'm telling you, do it for yourself. Everywhere Jesus was doing something or saying something, it was in the context of reaching people and teaching people and ministering to people. And that's where years ago, I came up with the vision for our, I didn't come up with the vision. I just took what Jesus did. And at our church, we say, here's what we're about. We're trying to reach people. We're trying to teach people. We're trying to minister to people because that's what Jesus did. And so, that's what we want to do. Now, let's look at number three. Number three is leaders must think transcendently before they think tactically. That is, what is the big transcendent cause and vision that we're pursuing? Because the tactics undergird that and support that. You don't start with your tactics first because that's upside down, don't you see? The vision don't support the tactics. The tactics support the vision. If there's no vision, no matter what the tactics are. So leaders, first of all, have to think transcendently. They got to have that vision. Now, we'll look at the big rock execution in a minute because sooner or later you got to get it down to tactics. But the transcendent cause comes first. Number four, the vision is to be the leader's constant focus and passion. And therefore, you pour your resources into that, your time, your energy, your money. You funnel that into the vision so that it gets accomplished. And let me just say something, folks, in a church especially. Well, let me say it this way. I had a man one time in the ministry, a young man, and he said, Alan, what is your greatest challenge in the ministry, and what is your greatest challenge personally? I said, oh, that's an easy answer. And I said, it's easy because it's the same answer for both. He said, really? I said, yeah. He said, what is it then? I said, focus. That's my main challenge in the ministry. It's my main challenge personally. You see, the church I'm at, it's a large church like yours, and there's always something coming at you. Another idea, something new, another trend, another fad, whatever. Here's this person's got an idea. This person's got an idea. And so there's something coming at you all the time. And I'll tell you, after a while, if you don't really work hard to be focused, you lose your focus and you start chasing things. I remember many years ago when they found 10 killer whales on the beach of San Diego. And the marine biologist did some discovery, and they found out that the reason those killer whales were beached and died was because they chased minnows into the shallow water too far. And the headline in the paper the next day said, killer whales died while chasing minnows. There's been a lot of church ministry leaders that's died chasing minnows. Because minnows are always swimming at you. And so you got to keep your focus. My favorite statement by Winston Churchill is simply this. He said that the nose of a bulldog is slanted backwards so he can continue to breathe without turning loose. Folks, when it comes to the ministry and you're the leader, you can't be dogmatic. You got to be bulldogmatic. Laser focused all the time. The bullet point here is simply this. Obsessed is just the word the lazy use to describe the dedicated. Vision, and stay on it, hold on to it, and have that slanted nose like a bulldog and don't turn loose. Let's go to Big Rock number 3, execution. And there's a big splash from Big Rock number 3, and that is nothing becomes dynamic until it first becomes specific. Sooner or later, it's got to be something you can grab your hands on and actually do. You know why the Bible is not dynamic in a lot of people's life? It's never specific. You know why that some people are never dynamic piano players? They never got specific enough to practice it enough. Nothing becomes dynamic until it first becomes specific. So let's look at this. Number one, execution is intentional. Execution is intentional. Now, every football coach knows that. They work on plays to execute them and be, this player is intentionally to do this on this play, and this player on this same place intentionally to do that, and they lay it out specifically and intentionally. You see, point A here, hope is not a strategy. Now, folks, hope's a wonderful thing to have, but it's not a strategy. You see, here's what we say in our churches. Well, I hope people get saved. That's not a strategy. It's not intentional. Now, if you want people saved, I want to say something. It's got to be specific enough that somebody's talking to them about Jesus. But just hoping people get saved don't get the job done. If it did, we'd already won the world. Because we do hope people get saved. But it's not intentional. In one of my books, I've got this statement, and I've just put it in your notes there, but good intentions alone are no better than no intentions unless you get intentional about your good intentions. I mean, if you've got good intentions but do nothing with them, then you accomplish the same as the guy that has no intentions. Point B. Without execution, great vision is rendered useless chatter. I've got a friend, and I love him. He's my brother in Christ. But I'll tell you, that dude can sit around with a cup of coffee and philosophize about ministry all day long, but he never gets up and goes to. There's been many times I wanted to say, would you just shut up and go do something in Jesus' name? Now, he's a good guy. Don't misunderstand me. But he loves to sit around and drink coffee with other ministers and talk about church and philosophy of all this stuff. But he never gets up from that chair and does anything. Drives me nuts. So, just useless chatter. Execution is intentional, but number two, execution is result-oriented. Again, I go back to a coach. You know why he's intentional about execution? Because he wants results. At the end of the game, he wants to look at the scoreboard and see his results. Look at point A. No matter how wonderful the vision, one must occasionally look at the results. And if you're not getting any results, then either your vision's bad or else you're not executing the good vision that you have. Milton Friedman here made a great statement, and I want to read it and then I want to translate it to the church. It's in your notes. One of the greatest mistakes is to judge policies and programs by their intentions rather than their results. You see, in the church, no one has more grand, more transcendent, more eternal, more glorious intentions than we. I mean, a business, their intention is to make a lot of money, but listen, when they die, what good's the money? A hospital's intentions is to heal sick people, and how wonderful that is, but guess what? They're still going to die. Nobody has intentions that are as grand and glorious and transcendent and as eternal as ours. And because of that, it has deceived us thinking everything's good. You see, we feel good about ourselves because our intentions are so wonderful, even if they never come to fruition. You see what I'm saying? So the more grand your intentions, it's easier to be deceived by those intentions, even when you're not getting anything done with them. Execution, I'm telling you, it's intentional, it's result-oriented, and number three, execution is specific. It is specific. Now, folks, we don't have time to do it, but if we did, I'd take you through a little Bible study. In Exodus chapter 25, God tells Moses, "Moses, I want you to build me a tabernacle, and I want you to have all the people to gather together, all these different kind of materials." And then he says, here's what I want you to do. I want you to build an ark. And he's going to say, here's how long the ark's to be. Here's how wide the ark's to be. Here's how deep it's to be. Here's the kind of the wood you're to make it out of. And then he goes to the table of showbread and tells him how he's to make it. And the curtains and the rods. And he starts in chapter 25 of Exodus. And he takes Exodus 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, and 30. Six whole chapters, God speaking to Moses and saying, here's exactly how I want every one of these instruments to be made. You know why? Because God gave Moses the specifics so he could execute. Have you ever heard this statement, the devil's in the details? You heard that statement before? Well, when I read Exodus 25 through 30, I said this, God's in the details. Leaders, you got to see the details. Now, that don't mean you do them all. But somebody's got to see to them that they're getting done. Moses didn't build all those instruments that went in the tabernacle. But he did have the specifics of how they were to be done. Notice point A here. At some point, our aspiration must turn to perspiration. We can aspire all we want to, but sooner or later we got to perspire. Point B, it says machines beat campaigns every time. Let me tell you where I got that statement. After Obama was reelected, Newt Gingrich wrote an article. And in the article, he said this: the Democrats win elections because they have a machine. They're constantly getting people registered to vote. They're constantly getting people to work on getting people to the polls. They're constantly working throughout the year on their image and spinning their message and getting with the media. And they've got a machine. But he said, us Republicans, we just do a campaign every 4 years. And then he said, machines beat campaigns every time. Now, folks, here's what I want to say about that. I know churches that try to make a living off events. Now, events are a wonderful thing to have, but you can't live off an event. There's got to be a machine, a process. And that process is called Life Bible Study Groups. It's week in, it's week out, it's always going. And the reason you have events is to enhance the process. But if you have no process, then your event really is just, it's nothing because it's not aiding the process. Y'all with me? And I know churches that become event-driven, and they have no process, and so those events is just a big hootenanny, and then it's over with. But it don't support the process. The bullet point here is leaders don't get what they want, they get what they execute. And then let me get through number four, and then I want to talk to you about our Sunday school ministry grid with what little time we have left. So here's number four. Vision minus execution equals no results. And then execution minus systems and structures equals no results. But vision plus execution plus systems and structures equals great results. So let's talk about that. Let's look at our Sunday school ministry grid. This is our church. It don't make it right for you, but at least maybe there's something you can glean from that. But at our church, we've already talked about from Matthew 4:23, Matthew 9:35, the three purposes, and there they are: reach people, teach people, and minister to people. By the way, what one word is in all three tasks? People. We're in the people business. And then personnel. If you're ever going to execute something, every task, somebody's got to own it. I mean, if not, when it's, hey, folks, when it's everybody's job, it's nobody's job. Come on, that's just the way it is. So somebody's got to own it specifically, intentionally. And so if you're going to do reach people, you got to have an outreach leader. If you're going to teach people, you got to have a teacher. If you're going to minister to people, in our setup, we have care group leaders. But then on Sunday morning, we have a structure. And at our church, we have 75 minutes for Sunday school. And so we take the first 10 minutes for fellowship. We take the next 5 minutes for announcements, promotions, emphasis. And then the next 60 minutes, the next hour, we spend on those three tasks. We give 10 minutes to the outreach leader. We give 30 minutes to the teacher. We give 20 minutes to the care group leader. Now, and here's what I found out over time. Whatever your purpose is, if it gets no airtime during prime time, it dies for lack of support. Because it's never before the people. And you got to keep it before the people. And remember, by the time you're sick and tired of saying it, they're just now getting it. You got to do it every week, over and over and over. And then we have systems. So we tell that outreach leader during that 10-minute period on the first and third Sundays of the month, take the prospect book into the class and distribute it so that we can do what we call MTV. Now, there's some stuff behind this that I don't have time to get into, but it simply means this. M, mail. T, telephone. V, visit. And so we're going to give it out so somebody can write them a note and mail it to them. Somebody else can call. Somebody else can visit. And what we try to do is rotate it. So one week, a particular prospect, John Doe, will get something in the mail from the class. The next week, he'll get a telephone call from the class. The next week, he'll get a visit from the class. The next week, we just start it over again. We get a mail again. And we just keep doing MTV, MTV, MTV over time until we're able to reach him. Because we're trying to reach him by building a relationship. And what does a relationship building take? Two things, time and touches. And so every week, we want to give a touch. This week, the touch will be a mail. The next week, it'll be a telephone. The next week, it'll be a visit over and over again. And then on the second Sunday of the month, we asked our outreach leader to have someone share their testimony. Now, there's several reasons for that, but let me just say this quickly. We do that because, you see, it helps to keep evangelism fueled. And left to itself, evangelism's dying in our churches and in our Sunday schools, and I'll tell you why. It's never talked about. It's never promoted on Sunday morning. And monkey see, monkey do. Our leadership is perfectly designed to pursue that result we're getting. It's no wonder people don't get saved. We don't ever promote it. It's never before our people. There's some other reasons for the testimony, but that's the main reason. And in the fourth Sunday, we ask them to discuss their SMP. For us, that stands for Strategic Mission Partnership, because we do all of our mission work by Sunday school classes. Every Sunday school class is a mission team. And we connect them with missionaries. For instance, I can take you to one of our classes, and they're connected with Leo Semenov in Moscow, and they go to Moscow, and they do missions. They don't go anywhere else. They go there. Once or twice a year, they raise their money. They work with him on what projects they're going to do, and they go do mission work over there. We got another class that they've got an SMP, Strategic Mission Partnership, with a missionary named Mike Mullins and Ludi Creech in Ireland. And they go over there and they do nothing but work with Mike and work with Ludi, and they try to help them to win Ireland to Jesus. And they don't go anywhere else. It's their Strategic Mission Partnership. I mean, a lot of churches come up with mission teams. We say everybody's supposed to be on mission. We've already got teams. Let's use them. All right, drop down to the minister to people. The care group leader has 20 minutes, and we asked our care group leaders to do four things in that 20-minute period. Number one, to take the roll, take attendance. We actually print our rows out by care groups. And that way, they can take that row in there, and the care group leader is going to take the roll. And the reason they're going to take attendance is, look at the second one, they're going to assign everybody that's there that morning a contact to make that week. Now, I want the care group leader to make contacts as well, to lead by example. But you see, I don't want the care group leader to make all of the contacts. I want the care group leader to lead the care group, because you see, Sunday school is a participatory sport. Everybody's supposed to be involved. And I want everybody in everybody's lives. And so we're going to ask everybody in that care group that morning to take the name of somebody that is not there and their phone number and call them and check on them that week. Now stop and think about, what if every adult left every Sunday and called one person? What would be the cumulative effect of that after 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 months? I'd say it'd be pretty significant. The third thing they do is they discuss ministry needs. Somebody's had a death in the family. Okay, who's going to funeral home? Who's taking the chicken casserole over? Somebody's having surgery. Who's going to go down and pray with them? Whatever. Folks, I'll tell you, and I'm very biased for my church, and I hope you're very biased for yours. But I'm telling you, these things work. We got a man in our church that went through leukemia. While he was in leukemia, his care group literally ran his small business for him. In one of our care groups, we had a lady that needed a kidney. And they prayed over that. And the next week, another lady came and said, I believe the Lord's led me to give you a kidney. There's some ministry taking place in there. And that's the fourth thing they do is they share prayer requests and they pray with each other. I think the prayer request ought to be done in smaller groups, not big, large groups, for several reasons. Number one, more prayer requests can be offered. More prayer can actually take place. And number three, more people get vulnerable in a small group that they won't in a large group. Okay. So that's the four things they do during the care group time. And then we asked our teacher to raise up an apprentice teacher and allow them to teach every 4, 5, 6 weeks so we can always be developing more teachers. So that's our purpose, our personnel, our structure, and our systems to execute, reach people, teach people, and minister to people. It's intentional, it's result-oriented, and it's specific. And so that's how we want to execute that. Okay. All right. I've got 2 minutes left. So I want, we got a prize. Christine's got a prize back here that we want to give away. And so we'll give it to the first person that can answer this question. What are the two verses that I use to say these three tasks of Jesus are the three tasks envisioned for our Sunday school? What's those two verses? You got it. Matthew 4:23 and Matthew 9:35. Hey, all right, give her a hand. She gets the Subway sandwich. By the way, I like Subway, don't y'all? Yes, sir, get that Philly cheesesteak up there. Oh, buddy. So, all right, listen, you've got a 15-minute break, and then you go to your third session, and thank y'all for being here. I've enjoyed getting to share this time with you.